We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry with overpriced, underperforming products, and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
Grinders, welcome to DFS pregame show here on Roto Grinders. I'm Jordan Cooper, aka Blender Ed, Blender HD. You're gonna follow me on Twitter, and it's Monday, March 6th. And you know what we do on Mondays? It's Mondays with McCool. We talk to James McCool, co-author with me on the Theory of Daily Fantasy Sports 15-hour audio DFS masterclass. You can pick up at theoryofdfs.com, as well as the advanced course, which includes James's custom Excel tools. If you're on the YouTube chat, feel free to post whatever you want in the YouTube chat. Doesn't matter to me. Hit the thumbs up button. Hit smash the like button. Hit the subscribe button. Good morning, early bird. Suki Singh, Guataz, Defic, Beat Boz. James Boz. I didn't have a very good MMA slate over the weekend. Minus 100%.
Ooh. That's rare. That's rare for you.
It's rare. I played 10 lineups, didn't cash any of them, and that's what'll happen when the two most overowned fighters make the optimal lineup.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a high scoring card too, right? Like there were a whole bunch of guys 115 plus, and
yeah. Basically, my strategy was to pretty much not have much of either 5-round fight. And John Jones was 38% owned, and he won early against Gon and crushed him pretty much. Mm-hmm. And then Alexa Grasso upset Valentina Shevchenko, and she was the only underdog that won on the entire slate.
Ah, yep.
And all right. I had her as the most overowned. She was 13% owned, and I still had her as the most overowned fighter on the slate. So I didn't have any of her. Like, it's good for sharp players when underdogs win, right? Yep. especially if they're underdogs that are not the higher owned underdogs. Like Jalen Turner was high owned, and he lost, and Manny Martinez lost. I mean that there were. I mean all the underdogs lost except for one, and then Dricus du Plessis, who was like one of the popular mid range fighters. I didn't have much of him, and he put up 115 points. So it was not very good for my leveraged lineups, and a lot of what I had that did win just didn't score very well.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, oh, okay. I have four winners in my lineup, but four low scoring winners. So don't even cash there. So not a particularly good MMA card for me. But Mike Brown, H3 Buddha. Very good one for him.
Yeah.
His first six figure win. He came in first and like third.
Good for him.
Well, he split for first with one lineup and then came in like second or the second best lineup,
yeah,
which was third place. So he took home like close to like 140,000.
Good for him. So this leads to a question for you. Would you rather play 10 lineups in MMA and go negative 100%, or play the NBA
DFS at all?
Play NBA DFS last night, where 367 did not cash high dollar entries.
Well, I mean the score is only relative to the chalkiness of the value.
I understand that, but just to answer the question, which one feels worse?
Minus 100% feels worse.
I don't know about that. I think that playing NBA DFS is one worse than playing MMA DFS. And two, if I nail a whole bunch of players, but everybody else nails other players, and it just ends up being a slate where 367, which wins GPPs a lot of nights, ends up not even min cashing, that feels considerably worse. I think that has to do more with my disdain for NBA DFS than anything, but just a tragic slate. They had Tyus Jones. Did you look at the NBA slate yesterday?
No, of course not. But all I know is that it seems like every day at NBA, DraftKings has like 700 mispriced players.
Yeah,
because of injuries and starting lineup rotations, where it becomes and it's not like you could play them all because there's like too many of them. So it's like kind of like here's 15 people that could go 10x, and then you build 3 8K plus players around them, and as long as you get like five of the 18 value guys that put up 40, and then like guys that you got the studs that put up 60 plus, like that's how you win. But the thing is that there's like 15 people that could put up 40 points for 5K or less.
Yeah, that's the problem here is. First off, I want to point out Ja Morant is suspended, all right, because he's a moron, because he did moronic things on the internet and he tried to do some dumb stuff. Okay, so he's suspended. DraftKings knew about the suspension, all right, like we knew it was coming.
Are you gonna tell me that Tyus Jones was still only like 3,600 or something?
3,100. Jordan, he's 4,500 on a normal slate. They priced him down. It's insane. So first off, I just wanted to point that out. That's why the slate was such a train wreck yesterday. He put up 55 fantasy points or something at 3,100. All right. Everybody starts with 18x player in their lineup.
Well, how owned was he?
He must have been 85% owned or something.
Okay, so under-owned then.
Under-owned. Absolutely under-owned. 100% under-owned. And then the other part, like what you were saying, where there's 15 players on a slate that can go 10x, and you have to hope to land five of them and then have the right AK plus players, that's to min cash. Because, like, to win a GPP, there's 15 players that can 10x. There's another 10 that can 9x. There's another 20 that can 8x. And so you have a player pool. Legitimately, player pools right now are like 65, 70 players that are worth playing on a slate on any given like 8 plus game slate. It's insane this year. even landing the good plays does not mean that you did well on a slate.
Well, that means you just have to adjust. I mean, to me, complaining or whatever, it just means that if you have a 4K guy that puts up 35 points, like, that's not worth playing anymore.
No.
Like that when people are comparing scores to last year or sure. a normally priced slate, it comes down to, well, if the pricing is off by that much, where it used to be that if you had a 5K guy, right, that puts up 35 points, be like, that guy could be in the winning lineup. It's now we can't. That's literally not good enough. If you have a 3K guy that puts up 25 points, nope, not good enough for the opportunity cost. You need to aim for higher because of how quote unquote mispriced everyone is. No, it's just the threshold has gotten higher.
Here's what I would argue. I agree with you on that the threshold has gotten higher. But there's a couple dynamics at play this season, specifically compared to last season's. You're right not to compare to the threshold that you needed in prior seasons. But I think that it's not just the threshold that's changed. It's the variance of the plays that are good or bad. Like, with such a wide selection, I think that it just has added randomness into what NBA used to be such like a good mathematical game. And that's why everybody has always said, like, nobody loses at NBA DFS, because if you played the best plays, quote unquote, then you were usually good. The problem is now that there are 27 best plays. You can't possibly
build 150 lineups with all 127. You can't lose, right?
No. But that's just 27 value plays, Jordan. So the permutations have gone so wide as to what is considered like a plus EV option that I think that it has made it really, really hard to, especially for single entry and three max players, which is, I work a lot with single entry and three max. That's a lot of people that are over at Paydirt. For single entry and three max, it has just become this exercise of variability and just hoping that like your five value plays out of the pool of 27 value plays are the five that end up being good enough. Because aiming high, I think that you're already aiming high with value plays. Like, if you have five guys that project for 7 to 8x or something like that, I'm not sure that you can aim much higher than that, because median expectation can't be higher than that, right?
Right.
But if there are so many of those players available, then it just becomes spinning a roulette wheel and hoping that you end up on the guys that end up having that huge ceiling game rather than just a regular ceiling game or their median expectation of 7x. So NBA DFS this year, I think, has been materially different in that trying to nail all of the value that you need rather than just like the main one or two guys, I think has been much more necessary than in years past. And I think that it has been much more variable.
Welcome to DFS. Isn't that what you got to do? And any sport and any sport.
Yeah. I'm drawing thoughts based on this NBA season compared to last NBA season.
Right. Cause I mean, like, let's say if you take the threshold down lower and it's like, oh, before there were 27 value. Well, how about a slate with like almost no value plays? Then you're still in the same spot. It's like, oh, look, there's 27 people that are projected for about the same. You're doing the same exact thing.
I'm not arguing that it has never been that you have to have the best plays. Like, yeah, that's DFS. I totally agree. I'm saying that for single entry and three max players, I think that it has been harder this year than it has in prior years. That's the only point that I'm trying to make. And I do think that that is true.
Well, coming up for this year, is it going to be harder than prior years? Is MLB DFS? We talked about this last week a little bit. We started to talk about it, about the new MLB rules. So what are these new MLB rules like? Okay, so we obviously seen the pitch clock.
Yep.
They're what are they doing with the defensive shifts now? That they're you can't just willy nilly make defensive shifts. So.
Yeah, so it's there's a dedicated alignment on the infield now. So in the infield, you can't shift over like your second baseman or your shortstop over in the infield now. There's dedicated positions of first, second, shortstop, third.
So basically the shortstop and third baseman can't defensively line up on the other side of second base.
Right. Yeah.
And so the second baseman and first baseman can't line, like, right. Basically you could only have, you could essentially only have two infielders on one side of second base.
Yep. That's right.
But the outfield, you could do whatever you want.
Yeah. Outfield is completely free game. But
the outfielders must be on the grass.
Yes. And we have seen that happen against Joey Gallo, I think, this year. Was it Joey Gallo? There was one player I did see that they did an outfield shift against. So we do know that it's going to happen against certain players that are extreme pull hitters. And they're just going to, like, force these guys to try to make a play to the outfield to the other side. So we do have that. Yeah, it was against Gallo the other day. So
yeah, he said, NMJ says in the chat, basically the left fielder playing where the second baseman used to.
Mm-hmm.
When the shift was allowed. That's why I said, as long they're moving the left fielder to the grass of the second baseman outfield, like in the outfield. So it's kind of like you're kind of playing like a second baseman, but like really deep second baseman.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But obviously you're leaving no one in left field because most likely he's not hitting the ball there anyway.
And that's going to improve offense a lot, I think, for guys who can actually like learn to beat that. There's going to be some doubles that are just so annoying this year because somebody's going to hit one down the line. It's going to turn into a double for like the slowest designated hitter. It's going to be like Nelson Cruz hits a double on a dink to the left or something like that. It's going to be really annoying. But yeah, so that's the shift rules.
Okay. Anything else in the rules?
So the bases are larger, significantly larger. Okay. And that's going to lead to an increase in steals. We have already seen that there has been a 20%+ increase in steals in spring training based on prior years. We have seen that because
is that going to when we say an increase in steals, I think that may be a misnomer. I think it's an increase in successful steals.
Well, no, because there's another part of the rules that makes it so the increases in steals is going to be there.
Is there anything in place that will incentivize teams to steal more?
Yes. The pitcher can't step off the mound more than once per at bat or more than once per like.
I thought it was two.
Or is it two? Okay. Yeah. Two pickoff attempts. Yeah. Limited to two pickoff attempts. That's massive.
Right. Because once he does two pickoff attempts, you know he can't do it anymore. And
right. Exactly. So the bases are larger and there's only two pickoff attempts. So steals are going to be a massive thing this year, like a notably large improvement. Anybody who has steal equity in their kit is going to be able to really pump up their numbers here and be really much more valuable.
That's if they choose to, but that's if they choose. I mean, you look at. I'm just gonna relate it to like football coaches.
Uh huh.
Like you can give them all the rules and all, like, dude, we can make it so that you like that you incentivize. We can make it so that. That the cornerbacks can't be more than three like miles of a receiver on the field, and like these teams will run on second and eight for 2 yards. I mean,
yeah,
like,
but we have
so, like you also need the managers that are they've been told, especially by their analytics department, for so long that going for steals is not necessarily the most useful. You know, it's not worth getting the out. At second base, that now with the bags being a little larger and the two pickoffs attempts, you still need managers that are willing to give the sign to Gay.
Right, but we've seen like
even if Billy Hamilton isn't on the bases, that some you could go for it if you can.
Yeah, but we've seen a 25% increase in years.
Spring training, who cares?
Yeah, but like if you're still measuring against spring training, we're not saying that it's a 25% increase on the regular season. We're saying that's 25% increase on prior spring trainings. Like that matters. That matters. So
in attempts or in success?
I'm pretty sure both. I'm pretty sure that it's a significant improvement on both. We have also seen an improvement on batting average on balls in play. So BABIP has gone from like...
Well, that's expected. I mean, with the shift alignment, with the shift
that is
dynamics now, right. You have to expect BABIP to go up. Maybe batting average doesn't go up, but at least at least it's not going to be this thing where most of the time when you put the ball in play, that's not over the fence.
Right.
And you're hitting it with your, you know, righties are hitting towards left field and lefties are hitting towards right field. Mm-hmm. And unless they're trying to hit to the other direction, like BABIP is going to be very low because you have all the fielders. You have seven guys there to get the ball.
Right. So we have seen an increase in batting average on balls in play for sure. I think it went from like 240 to 270, something like that, 30-point increase. Again, this is based on prior strength trainings. So we are seeing more people on base, and we are seeing more stolen bases. And then we are also seeing the pace of play down, and I imagine that the good pitchers are going to also see an increase in upside. And the reason for that is with pitcher calm, because that's the other change that we see. Like, we have the pitch clock, but we also have pitcher calm. So pitchers are calling their own stuff from the mound now. They're not waiting to see what they're going to throw. They're having that conversation ahead of time. So what we're seeing is an increase in speed of pitches delivered. And we're also seeing that pitchers are able to do more of what they want to do and accomplish more of what they want to accomplish. So
that a good thing, but hey, for some pitchers, that may not be a good thing.
That's what I just said. So good pitchers, I think, are going to see a ceiling increase, like the Max Scherzers. And I think the smart pitchers, you know, the guys that are really, really good at tunneling, the guys who understand their stuff, have great command. I think that we'll see some pretty notable increases for them as well. But maybe
the decreases. I mean, we're theorizing here.
We are.
But I'm thinking of guys like Hunter Green. Mm-hmm. Like the guys, the fireball guys.
Yeah.
Like, to me, I could even see them being even wilder.
Yeah, I could too.
Where they're just like, well, they're young, they throw hard, and either they're going to give up more home runs. This is complete theory. Is that I'm just picturing a 23-year-old kid, 24-year-old fireballer that has to pitch within 15 seconds.
Yeah.
And never had very good command to begin with, just throws hard, and he only has two pitches. So he has like a fastball and some secondary pitch that is halfway decent, and that's why he's in the majors. And he just defaults to just, crap, I got to go. I'm just going to throw it hard.
Yeah.
And which means that the batters are going to be more likely to be able to call fastball, knock him out of the game, you know, hit a home run, or he's just going to be so wild. Because he doesn't have like some 36-year-old catcher calming him down, you know, every pitch and go, okay, let's try it here, let's try it there, and he's just going to get rattled. I mean, this is pure theory. It could be the opposite. It could be some of these kids, maybe they come up and they just like, okay, all I have to do is don't think about anything and just throw it hard, and they get 17 strikeouts. I mean, like, it could be that.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I think that's a fair point. There's going to be guys where I'm trying to think of who, like two pitch guys. I think that's a really good point. Guys who only have a fastball and a slider and are going to panic and say, oh, well, I just need to get this pitch off. Like he doesn't have time to figure out what he needs to do. So he's just going to throw another fastball and hope that he gets it past him. And especially in situations where it's like an 0-3 count and he needs to get a strike in there. And he's just like, all right, well, I'm just going to try to blow it past him twice. Like that's going to be tee off season for a lot of the hitters that are able to find these fastballs. So I think that's going to widen. Maybe I shouldn't say it'll raise the ceiling of good pitchers. Maybe it'll widen the range of outcomes for all pitchers. Let's say that. I think that's a fair way to put it.
But do you think the pitch count is in favor of the pitchers more than the hitters?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Do you want to know why?
Well, I mean, I theorized about one thing. I mean, I saw clips of like in spring training where like there are pitchers that are striking people out in like 22 seconds.
Yeah.
Because the batter doesn't even have to, like, the batter kind of like steps out, not just steps one foot out and is like, oh no, I gotta stay in here. Like the batters are not used to having to be ready. They're used to, they're not allowed to step out and walk around like they used to, but at least they were like, okay, I could get, okay, get my grip good, dig in a little bit more, do the little thingy thing, like with the bat and what it, like no, it's like you don't step out at all. This pitcher is just going to get the ball back, and he's ready to go.
Yep. Yeah. So the reason why pitchers will benefit from this is first move advantage. So in every competitive game, first move advantage ends up winning out over time. And pitchers just have not, one, they haven't really had the ability to abuse it in baseball because of what you were talking about with hitters just like walking around and sipping a margarita while they wait to like get ready to go up to bat. But two, they also haven't had the pitch clock egging them on to then abuse it as well. So it's been on both sides. I think that both hitters and pitchers have been waiting and like trying to do this mental game. But now I think it's going to become much more brute. And I think that first move advantage is going to be really, really important for pitchers. So what I theorize is going to happen here is hitters are not going to be ready to deal with pitchers that are abusing the pitch clock. So like we saw Max Scherzer, he got set and he sat there and he did not move because once the pitcher is set, he can now pitch as soon as the batter steps in the box. Right. And we saw him get set. The hitter called time, stepped back for like 3 seconds. As soon as he was in stance, Max threw a fastball straight past him. Like you can't touch that. That hitter's not going to be ready for it. So I do think that pitchers, so long as they understand that they have first pitch advantage, again, this is going to come to if a pitcher is waiting. I mean, Sonny Gray, for instance, like he might not use first move advantage.
Sonny Gray may not be in the league anymore with this pitch. I don't know.
Yeah. Like, he took like 30 seconds.
What, like, and do we have stats on that? Do you, because I'm assuming I could ask Cardi maybe if he has the data on what are the pitchers like. This is here's a theory to throw out that you could test,
yeah,
or at least start the test. Is the pitchers that normally, like, let's say we have a pitcher. Sonny Gray is the example on the other side of the spectrum. But let's say there was a pitcher that their average time between pitches was 14 seconds.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, within 15 seconds, like, should the clock have much of an effect on him? Then there are ones that 17 seconds, 18 seconds. So there's a 3 second gap. Now Sonny Gray is like 28 to 30 seconds between pitches. Is there going to be, it would have to assume negative effect on like, what is Sonny Gray going to look? What is his performance going to look like now? And it could be the other way where it turns out when he throws quicker, he's actually better. And what he was doing before was the bad thing. But like, there has to be some way of measuring like and adjusting for like pitch. There are certain pitchers that pitch fast, between pitch is fast as it is. And some that are really long that, is there going to be that big of an adjustment? I mean, obviously we're dealing with no sample size, but as Cardi would say with some of this stuff, when it comes to pitching, this seems like something that would normalize, not quick, but quicker than other stats. Cause like what normalize means, just to highlight, like pitch speed is quick to normalize. Why? Because that's not going to, how varying is a pitcher's speed from game to game, right? So if like his first start, he's throwing his fastball at 96 miles an hour. And then the next start, he throws it at like 93 miles an hour. And the next start, he throws it at 95 miles an hour. Like, you're not going to see like, oh, well, maybe he throws it at 91 the next game. It's like, no, like it's going to be within that range of like pitch speed. And the same thing is with in between pitches. The time in between pitches is going to be fairly consistent, like in the past, for that past data, that I would say like the effects of that on the pitch clock on the pitcher stats could be noticeable quicker than we need 5 seasons worth of data in order to, you know, to get anywhere close to one standard deviation. But I think it'll be fairly within a month or two, figuring out if the pitch clock has any predictive power and some type of dynamic on any of the stat categories.
Well, yeah, I think that It's hard to say. I think it's hard to say because if we look at, like, with the example of Sonny Gray, he takes 30 seconds to pitch. Is that because he can't pitch quickly or because he has not tried, right? If he has tried and he's bad at it, then it might be a disaster for him, but he might get better at it. We don't know. If he has not tried and he ends up being incredible with it, then is that going to stick or is he then going to kind of fall apart a little bit because he got a little bit lucky at the beginning? We don't know. For hitters, I think that it's really interesting to look at because hitters kind of train to hit a certain way their entire lives. Like, it's really hard. We'll see hitters change their stance in small incremental ways. Like, maybe Cody Bellinger, instead of holding the bat up here, holds it down here, right? Like, we'll see these incremental changes that are noticeable if you know what you're looking for. But if you don't, then it's kind of hard to view. Somebody having their hips widened out a little bit or keeping their hands tighter or looser or whatever. But these changes are made in the off season. And then when you come into the season, there's very little time to make adjustments. So for hitters, if you've kind of worked your entire life into a rhythm, because we know that hitters hit in a rhythm and the pitch clock makes it so you can't get into a rhythm, I don't know that that normalizes across the league. Maybe it normalizes on a hitter basis. Maybe, like, straight up now, Josh Donaldson literally cannot hit a pitch anymore. And he's old, so he might just be dust anyway. But, like, maybe Josh Donaldson goes from being, like, a 280 average hitter to, like, a 210 average hitter. Now he just sucks. But I don't know if that normalizes across the league more than it normalizes at a player level. It's hard to say. I'm not sure.
I think all of this is hard. I mean, that's why... it's 3 weeks before the season. I'm trying to figure out the main thing that we're trying to figure out here. Okay. You, James,
yeah,
and even Cardi, you like figuring out this type of stuff to figure it out as an intellectual challenge. Me, how does it make me more money?
Right.
And in DFS or in sports betting or in prop betting and stuff like that, I could see the issue with the benefiting. I can see, in general, I think the game will still be three outcome based. I still think we're not going back to the mid-80s Cardinals teams, 2-1 National League Baseball.
No, because pitchers are too good now. Pitchers are too good now, so we can't have that.
Right. So it's still going to be geared towards, it's either going to be a walk, a strikeout, or a home run type of a thing, but it's going to be a little bit less of it. A little bit. The BABIP is going to go up, which means we're going to get some more hits and doubles and people on base and things like that.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Pro teams have millions to spend, and they don't always spend them wisely. But when it comes to a great shave, you don't have to shell out tons of cash. Harry's saw customers getting ripped off by the shaving industry with overpriced, underperforming products and decided to do something better. They found their own way to make beautifully designed razors for a fraction of the price of the other big brands, so you never wonder if you overpaid. Harry's shaving products look great, and the weighted handle makes shaving feel great, too. I like to keep my beard neat, and Harry's always leaves me with a smooth yet crisp shave. Harry's quality is top-notch, thanks to German-engineered blades made in their own factory that stay sharp longer. You can get a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel cover for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. And Harry's has the highest customer satisfaction in the shaving industry, plus a convenient subscription option that you can cancel at any time. Getting the best doesn't mean spending the most when you shave with Harry's. Get started with a $13 trial set for just $3 at harrys.com/bluewire. That's harrys.com/bluewire for a $3 trial set.
I think the effect from a DFS perspective is that this is more likely to benefit correlation than it is than anything. Actually, we're going to lean back, because when it's like, oh, we have a 12-game slate and a lot of people, like, you need, if you're going to stack five people, it's essentially like, do the Twins hit 5 home runs today?
Right.
Right, like that type of thing. And then, obviously, you know, there are benefits of correlation when one guy gets on base and then this guy hits a double, then the next guy hits a home run, like that type of stuff. But I think maybe we get a 10% increase towards correlation if the BABIP is going to be higher. And steal attempts, and the bases are going to be bigger, which means obviously even on tag plays on third from an outfield throw, or even speed guy outrunning someone at first base on a ground ball.
Yeah,
the base is going to be bigger. The first baseman, the players can't block the base as much, right? So I would think that this benefits correlation. Definitely. And regardless of the pitch count, like the pitch count stuff, how would you even adjust for that from a DFS perspective? Like, well, if this affects all pitchers in X way, well, then how do I change what I was doing before? Am I not playing Max Scherzer? No, I'm still playing Max Scherzer regardless, right? I'm still playing Verlander regardless. I'm still those are the best pitchers anyway. Like I'm not really changing anything. The only thing I'm not changing stacking either in MLB no matter what. But I just think that maybe the lineups that are like 3-2-2-2, you know, like those types of lineups, I'm going to do a 2-2-2 and a 3-2-1-1 go a little bit less in value. Not out of value, but I just think that if there's going to be more balls in play, it benefits correlation. The steals go up, which means you could have a guy gets 3 points for a single, steals second, has 8 points, right? And then the next guy hits a home run. Well, you got the steal already. Like you had double steals. The steal I can see there being a metagame with the steals, because if they're only allowing 2 pickoff attempts, does that really mean that they're only allowing 1?
Yeah.
Because do you want to be a pitcher that has used 2 pickoff attempts and then knowing that on the next pitch you can't make a move to a base? Like, you don't want to be stuck in that spot, right? You might as well go to the windup in that situation. And of course, once you go to the windup, I don't see why the slowest guy could steal second base from the windup position in the major leagues. So it's like, is it really that 1 pickoff attempt becomes the new 2 pickoff? Like, once the pitcher has tried to pick you off once, that should be the sign. After a while, when they see that pitchers don't do the second pickoff attempt, now people go on the after the first pickoff attempt, because they're like, nope, they don't want to get in a spot where they can't throw the ball to first base anymore. Like, do you think there's some type of meta chicken game like that? And maybe that the pitchers don't, maybe the meta thing for pitchers is to never attempt a pickoff.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, I'm, it's going to be so rare that you have to wait. You're never going to know when it's going to come.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously all this stuff is done to speed up the game, not necessarily make the game of baseball better, but you're just trying to theorize how the players and how the managers are going to react to these rules. And for the main purpose of, hey, if steals are going to go up dramatically, like I wouldn't be on that. Like, dude, especially for sports betting.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's probably where you make the most money, is like in the first month, just hammering overs on steals. Just anyone who can steal a base, just bet the over on two stolen bases for like everyone, honestly.
But here's a question. Is because of this new rule, how much of an effect of the pitcher mattering? Because we know the classic example, Noah Syndergaard.
Right.
Awful. Probably maybe one of the worst pitchers holding on runners in the history of Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
And we have statistical proof of that.
Yeah.
How much does it affect those types of guys? Like, does it change anything? Like, does it really change anything for him at all? I mean, like.
Yes, kind of. Only because I think that people will be more willing to go for steals now. They'll get used to it. Whereas, like, maybe in the past, we knew that you always just want to attack Noah Syndergaard with steals, but maybe managers who are old and decrepit did not quite grasp it, right? And now I think they will be more willing or more understanding of that situation. From a how does this make me money standpoint, I think you're hammering the over on steals early in the season. But also, I will say that I have to assume that sportsbooks will look at the increase in steals. So maybe there won't be as much juice on that as I assume. But from a stacking and from a DFS perspective, I think just based on all of this, because we do think that good pitchers will be better. I think that bad pitchers will be worse and average pitchers will have higher variance. So this isn't anything groundbreaking, but attack bad pitchers more than you would before. Right, because like in the past, I think that you would want to take shots on like relative, like maybe slightly above average pitchers. Like you would want to attack them because there would be lower ownership on stacks. But this year, I do think that bad pitchers, especially pitchers who struggle, like there might be something where looking at the data and saying this guy is usually bad the third time through the order, maybe the second time through the order now, guys just get cratered because there's such a mental aspect to pitching. And if a guy gives up a home run and then has to pitch again in the next 9 seconds or whatever, you're not quite over giving up that home run yet. And I think that that might lead to more chains. So I do think that stacking will be more important than before, like you said. But I do think that the 3-3-1-1 lineups or whatever those are going to be, I do think that there will be such upside in stolen bases that one-offs at second base and shortstop will be valuable. So that's the one like kind of specific theory that I'll have here is in the past, you kind of, if you were stacking a team, you kind of wanted to include the catcher and the second baseman in that team because typically they're weak positions. So you're betting on correlation to carry those positions for you. Now I think that second base, since that's
now, you may get a Nicky Lopez 360.
Yeah.
Right out of the blue, you know, like the low end hitters that barely hit for power that you typically only use as a stack. Like Billy Hamilton is to me the quintessential example.
Right,
if he's still in the league,
yeah,
he typically gets a job somewhere, and he typically gets called up at some point where he's batting ninth. He has an OPS of like 120. But if he gets on base, he can steal two. I mean, like his outcomes are as wide as Joey Gallo's, just without home run. Like he'll never hit a home run, but he will get 30 points in a game or zero in a game.
Absolutely. So I think that we will see. You'll feel like you can one off second base a little bit more, one off shortstop a little bit more. I think maybe
shortstop. That's a kind of a power position now.
Shortstop has a lot of premium to it. Yes. But I do
think second base is a little weaker. Yeah, I would agree. But shortstop, dude, we have Seager and Turner.
We have Correa.
Story. I mean, come on. Shortstop is a power position.
Yeah, shortstop has a lot of power, but it also has a lot of stolen base upside at the cheaper guys who hit towards the back of the order, which is why I think that you'll be able – like, yeah, you have the power of Trevor Story who can hit that home run and maybe get a double, get you 19, or you have the eight hole hitter Jorge Mateo, and he can get you now three stolen bases and a double. And like, it's the price difference there, Trevor Story being 5K or Jorge Mateo being 2,500, like that matters. I think that you're going to be able to see those opportunities a little bit more and not bank on correlation at the cheap spots anymore. Maybe I should say the cheap spots outside of catcher. I don't think you'll have to bank on correlation as much as you did before. That's probably like my main theory. That, and I think that the high upside pitchers, any pitcher who is smart enough to abuse first move advantage is going to be terrific to like at least for like 3 months. I'm not sure who that's going to be yet. Like, we'll see. That's the guessing game right now. We don't know who the pitchers are going to be that are able to really abuse that. But I do think that we're going to see some guys who maybe are not the best pitchers in the world, but are smart and understand their pitches and understand tunneling and understand their abilities. I think those guys are going to have a higher floor and probably a higher ceiling than we have seen before.
If you're a subscriber to the Bat, which is available now, you could go purchase that for the MLB season, Cardi's projection system that he's worked on for over a decade. The key questions with this new MLB rules for him, the two guys we need to know how it affects the most. Number one is Drew Smyly, right?
Okay.
Is how much of it, I'm just picturing that the poster boys of the Bat for pitcher, Drew Smyly, and for batter is Rougned Odor. Like, it's like what's the effect on those two guys? Then we can see how it affects the rest of the league, because those are the two guys that the Bat always seems to love. But it's not, because what people get wrong is that, oh, the Bat loves Drew Smyly and Rougned Odor. It's like, no, it's the DraftKings pricing algorithm hates them.
Right.
So like, when they're actually like, when Rougned Odor is priced at 4K, the Bat doesn't love him or anything.
No, it's just that when
they price him at 2,800 every slate, that's what happened. When Drew Smyly is 6,100 as a pitcher, when he should be like 7,800, from a point per dollar value, he's going to come across and the Bat is very good. And then when DraftKings never raises his price, it's just going to consistently be that way the entire time. So like, it's not a thing that the projection system loves a guy. It's more that the pricing on the sites, though, they're always underpriced.
Yeah. Yeah. I Smyly usually projects pretty well, but my models usually tend to stay away from him because of things like true average and expected home run rates and stuff like that. Rougned Odor, I don't know, man. I think Rougned Odor is probably going to be worse. Here's my theory on these two guys. I think Odor will be worse because he is going to have to deal with pitch clock and he's going to have to swing a lot. And all he does is just like swing and hope that he hits something. But I think that the pitches will come so fast, he won't be able to reset his stance as well. That's a completely baseless theory. For Drew Smyly,
you acted like I was asking these questions like legitimately.
Well, I'm answering them legitimately. So Drew Smyly, I think Drew Smyly will actually benefit from it. I think that he'll benefit from first move. Those are my guesses.
Right. I was expecting more facetious answers.
No. We're here for real answers here and real suggestions. My real suggestion is that Kyle Bradish is going to be awesome this year.
Oh, so that's your take. That's your hot take.
That's going to be my hot take right now. Yeah, I think Kyle Bradish...
Does he still pitch for the Orioles?
Yeah.
Okay, because remember, I don't know who's on what team until like the day before the first slate of MLB. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Kyle Bradish and Brian Bello for the Red Sox. I think those guys both have a lot of upside, and they were both guys that my models liked a lot. True average liked them a lot, so... I'm hoping that Kyle Bradish ends up, because my models just were absolutely in love with him last year, and I think they're going to continue to be this year unless you change things dramatically. And usually when that happens, a pitcher sucks that year and then it's good the next year. So
storm in your what dynasty league or something?
Yeah.
For next year, or keep
best ball or whatever you're doing. I should have done best ball this year. I didn't do best ball for baseball, and I should have.
You still have time, though, right?
I don't know. I guess there's time, but I mean, now I have to build out the model. So like, I don't have much time to focus on best ball.
Okay, well, you could always use the bat.
I could use the bat. No, that's true. I could. And I love Cardi's model, too. I think he's very good.
Right, and then you go to Underdog. You use the promo code Grinders. You get your $100 deposit match, and then you play some MLB baseball.
There you go.
I'm not doing it, but I mean, there is an edge there. There's an edge everywhere. That's why, like, NMJ says, like, what's my MLB contest selection for this year? I'm going to be focused on the 3X, 5X style contests and the small field 121, $200 4MAX type of stuff. That doesn't mean there is an edge in the large field. There's plenty of that. Dude, large field has the biggest edge. It's just the hardest to realize. I could, but I mean, I'm not going to be in a position where I want to play 50 lineups in a night, but I could. Like, that's why the contest selection questions are kind of stupid. It's like there's 800 edges, but you're only one person. So, like, take the ones that you think that you're the strongest and doing and willing to handle the variance, right? Because, like, I could say, well, it's like, you know what the biggest edge contest there is in DFS? It's the NFL Millie Maker. That is the biggest edge available to you. Now, are you? Let's say you're playing 10% of your bankroll, which I think is too high. Are you going to just play? I'm going to max that out and play 10% of my bankroll. You're going to be most likely 90%+ of the time you're going to end up broke or near broke.
Yeah.
Even though it's the biggest edge, so it's like, if you're willing to do that, sure, okay, go for it, I guess. But I mean, if you're not. Maybe you only play 10 lineups into that contest. Maybe you just don't play any. It's the biggest edge contest, but from a expected ROI within your lifetime type of thing, and not an EV thing. It's like, no, I'd rather play the small field contest where it's there's still an edge, it's lower edge, but I'm more likely to realize that within the next 3 to 5 years than the Millie Maker. Yeah. It's not That's why when people ask, well, which contest are you playing? Like, I play soccer cash games. And they go, well, I don't know anything about soccer. I said, yeah, because I have an edge in soccer cash games. That's why I play soccer cash games. What do you have an edge in? Like, the number one thing is, what do you have an edge in? And then if the answer is, I have an edge in 78 things, and then it's like, oh, well, which one should I play? Like, whichever. If you could only play 6 of the 78, choose whatever 6 the hell you want to.
Here's the answer in a slightly less insulting way. You should play the contest that fits your goals. So Jordan's goals.
But you need an edge. But first you need an edge.
No, sure. But like you don't play
contests where you don't think you're a winner.
You don't even get into figuring out where your edge is until you figure out why you want to play. You shouldn't even be playing.
I want to make all the money, James. I want to make all the money.
Yeah. That's how most people look at it, but that's wrong. You should be playing in a way that fits your goals. And before you even start the MLB season, instead of asking Blender what contests he is going to play, you should be asking yourself what you want to accomplish with MLB DFS this year. And if the goal is to make secondary income, then you start thinking about that and you talk to people who make secondary income from it and pick their brain on how you should accomplish that. If your goal is to save up for a vacation at the end of the year, then you should think about how much money you need to make that and then look at what contests you have an edge in and the best way to realize that edge in 1 year. And then if you want to just have beer money, if you just want to like make $200 a month, then think about the best way to end up meeting that goal. If you want to go for a live final seat, like go for it. Absolutely. You go have fun and try to get yourself a live final seat. Understand that goal is going to be very feature famine. And if you're going to attack that, then you have to understand that as well. So it's less about asking people what the best contest to play is. It's more about figuring out why you want to play and the reasons why you play for any sport, for all of DFS, and then trying to figure out the best way to accomplish that goal. That's what it's more about.
Right. My goal, I believe that playing triple ups, quintuple up type contest on both DraftKings and FanDuel, as well as, you know, making one or two, like $121, $200 single entry lineups for both sites, as well as hitting Prize Picks and Underdog, you know, when the boards first go up.
Yeah.
Right. The key is when the boards first go up that on my volume, I think I have a very good chance of a near not 100% chance, but a very very high percentage chance that over the course of the MLB season, by the end of the MLB season, I'll make $50,000 to $60,000.
There you go. And that's your goal, is to make $56,000. That's right. Your goal. So that's more what it's about. I believe that the path that
I'm taking is the least variant path.
Yeah, because you don't want to make $250,000.
Right. Yeah. The thing is, I'm giving up the opportunity of having a 250K season.
Right.
Or having a negative season. Right. Or having like, I only made 10K this MLB season, or I lost 5K, but I had the upside of making 300,000. Like, I'm giving up that range, but I'm increasing the likelihood of me losing money on the season is almost is nearly zero. And a bad season would be like, I only made 20 grand.
Yeah.
Right. I only made 10 or 20 grand. An average based on this would be, I made 40, 45 grand. And like the goal, like 60th, 70th percentile is like 60, 70,000.
Yeah.
Then maybe if I run great, I make 100,000. But on another, if I play different contests and I run great, maybe I end up making $1 million over the course of an MLB. If you run like the sun, right? But I'm taking away that variance,
right?
Because I don't want to even lose money. So like my goal is in that range there. So then if that's the goal, okay, then how do I manufacture that? Yeah. Like what contests and what edges should I go after? Doesn't mean, hey, I played plenty of seasons large field. I mean, a lot of my years are large field GPPs, and you can see that, you know, I made 80,000 in a year playing DFS, and it's like, yeah, on big spikes and big downswings, and then by the end, it's like there it is at 80K, right? Maybe I don't want to do that anymore. Maybe I can, but it kind of sucks to play for 4 or 5 months and be like, just see your thing go, and then you question whether or not anything you're doing is okay.
Yeah, and you're just mainlining Arby's at this point. Like you just hate yourself at that point. That's why I don't play like seriously anymore, because I figured out that my mental health and like my ability to run models is and maintain my sight is better when I'm not just tilted over the moon at a downswing lasting 2 months and worrying about if I'm going to be able to pay rent like that. It just doesn't
work. That's why you only play a percentage of your bankroll. That's why you move up and down.
Right.
You go on a downswing, then you move down, then you move up. Then you, I mean, most people aren't disciplined. I am disciplined.
Right.
So
because you're in
most people aren't. Most people think, I lost a lot. Minus 100% on MMA. That means James, on this next slate, I got to double down and get it back, right?
Yeah, you have to triple down, because what if you have the nuts, Jordan? What if you have it? You could make $170,000.
Right. I just got to triple down. I got to quadruple down.
Yeah, you got to play more volume. You got to play more volume.
I got to put it all in.
We have a couple questions here. So B Shot asks, checking this morning, Tyus only 70% owned in my cheap SE GPPs. How does that happen? Well, the main thing here is cheap GPP. Cheap GPPs are typically going to have less of the really, really strong players. And some people are just not paying as much attention. Some people fade it. Even the good players will sometimes look at a cheap SE GPP and just be like, doesn't matter, whatever. And maybe there's a CSV error or something like that. He should have been 100% owned. I'm not sure exactly what he was owned in the large field stuff, but I know that he was like 85% owned in the 888. So it mostly just comes down to the people in your contest are softer.
He must have projected for like 40 points.
He projected for 35.
35 median? Right, so that's a 10, that's an 11x. Yeah, that... Essentially, that becomes I play him in every lineup.
You lock him. You just start there and move along.
Because like, you also know that he's going to be under. Like the thing is that 85% he's going to be under owned also.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm gonna build for relative value purposes and have him be negative leverage. Like he's positive leverage even at that ownership. So
yeah.
Like,
I mean,
I'm assuming I could go to Results DB and all the sharp players will have like him at like. Virtually 100%.
Yeah, they had to have. This was this year's version of Gordon Hayward at min price. Like, it just at 97% owned, maybe he's slightly overowned. But are you at that point? Does it matter? No.
Yeah, but he's not going to be 97% owned. But that's the thing, because people are going to be like, "Oh, I can't play the chalk." Like, okay, you don't understand what you're doing.
No, so somebody in my Discord was like, "Oh yeah, that's a full fade." I was like,
"No, he's underowned.
No, it's not. Just don't play the slate. Right. Just don't play the slate."
Well, that's one of the top things that people don't get about leverage, is that it's not about chalk or not chalk. It's chalk or not chalk. It's overowned or underowned, and how much they're overowned and underowned. Like, so there are plenty of times, and like we see in NFL where the $4,500 running back is going to be like 26% owned and one of the higher owned players on the slate. I'm going to fade that guy. It's like, what if they told you he should be 45% owned?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, he's drastically under owned. You should be playing a ton of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and then James Johnson asked, who do you got winning Toronto versus the Nuggets? I don't know, but my models will be up very soon and they'll tell you over at Pater.
That's all your range of outcomes.
Say that again.
They'll tell you a range of outcomes.
Well, no, I mean, the game betting model just gives you a money line and a spread. But we can run range of outcomes for all the players in those games. Yep.
Okay. So that's at paydirtdfs.com.
Yeah, paydirtdfs.com. Just reformatted the NBA betting models. And they're really slick now. You can run different stat categories and stuff like that. So you should go try that out. And obviously, getting ready for baseball season. Baseball's the best. So we're getting stoked on that.
And when you're getting ready for baseball season, go purchase the Theory of DFS for advanced players. Get get 6 hours of audio and the custom Excel tools, especially if you're building a ton of stacks, right? You have in the portfolio trimmer and the stuff that it'll even show the stack.
Yep.
You don't even have to go by like, if this guy's in the lineup, that's a Dodger stack. It's like, no, like you literally identify the MLB stacks.
Yeah, and I'm going to be adding some things onto those tools this week, getting ready for baseball season, adding in like the ownership of the stacks and stuff like that too. So,
and the portfolio trimmer.
And the portfolio trimmer, right. So Jordan is going to let me know the things that are on his wish list coming into the baseball season, and I'll add those things in, and we'll get some nice upgrades and updates to the Theory DFS before the baseball season.
Right. And even if you have already purchased it, like, you could always go and download the tools from the site again, whenever there's an update. And James, you always send out an email.
Yes. Yep.
Right. I haven't seen an email in a while.
No, we haven't done very many updates, but right. I did figure out the MacBook issue. So I'll have an email on that here pretty soon.
It works on my Mac.
That's because you have automation macros enabled on your security settings. Default so MacBooks do not.
Yeah, but all you have to do is change that setting.
Right. But we didn't know that. So people were like, it was so.
Oh, so basically, all you're going to do is add the instructions on how to do
it. To go in and enable automation macros, because on MacBooks that is automatically disabled in Excel, and on Windows it is automatically enabled. So if you had a MacBook and you tried to run it, then a lot of the macros
are not going to happen. Right.
Right. So for those of you who have asked questions about that, that's how you fix that. I'll send out an email this week after I put in some updates.
Okie doke. Well, you can check that out at theoryofdfs.com. James is at paydirt_DFS. I'm at BlenderHD. Hit that thumbs up button. Hit the like button. Smash the like button. Smash it. Hit it.
Oh, yeah.
Punch it. Do whatever you want with the like button. Helps us out. Free content here. We got tons of other stuff later today. They got NBA. We got MLB, PGA, MMA, XFL. XFL stuff. We got college basketball. We got everything here at Roto Grinders. So sign up, get a combo premium package. Click on that link in the description, get $10 off your first month. And I will be back tomorrow answering your DFS strategy questions like I always do, Monday through Friday, 11 o'clock Eastern, on the DFS pregame show on rotogrinders.com.